Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association.
Thomas Davenport is a renowned thought leader who's helped hundreds of companies worldwide to revitalize their management practices. He combines his interests in business, research, and academia as the president's distinguished professor in management and information technology at Babson College, and as a visiting professor at the Harvard Business School for the 2012-2013 academic year. He's also co-founder and research director of the International Institute for Analytics, and he's a senior advisor to Deloitte Analytics. He's the author of several books, most recently, Keeping Up with the Quants, Your Guide to Understanding and Using Analytics. So, Tom, in your book, Keeping Up with the Quants, you suggest that everyone needs to have analytical skills. Why do you think that's the case?
We just live in an analytical world these days, no matter what part of business you're talking about, even in things like sports and content creation and media and so on. The decisions are increasingly made through analytical means, and even if you're only going to be subject to those decisions, it's quite important, I think, to have an idea of how the decision was arrived at. And in many cases, I think if you're in an organization and you work with customers, customers will ask questions like, well, how did you come up with that particular recommendation for me to a call center worker or something like that? If the call center worker says, you know, I don't know, it's just what the computer says, that's not going to be a very compelling argument for the customer to go along with that suggestion or recommendation.
You know, decision-making is clearly being pushed down to the lower levels of employees. So along those lines, does that mean analytics should be very much a part of their skill sets as well?
Well, it is. I talked about several levels of analytical people in my first book, I think, Competing on Analytics. So you have the hardcore analytical professionals who create the new algorithms and so on. And then you have the semi-professionals, the people who are really good at spreadsheets and so on. That's kind of MBA level analytical skills. But then you have the people at the front lines, the analytical amateurs, I call them, who are being presented every day now with analytical decisions made either on their behalf or on customers' behalves, and they need to have some sense of where it came from, what data was used, what were the primary variables in the equation. As I said earlier, in part to explain it to customers, we see in healthcare increasingly there are all these recommendations about what treatment protocols to use, maybe a score that suggests, you know, how likely you are to get diabetes or come down with a heart attack or something. If you're a nurse or a doctor, you're presenting that to a patient, they're going to have some questions about how did you come to that conclusion, and you know, they want to know whether they should act on the advice or not. So you have to really understand it to some degree, at least, you know, not the details of the algorithm, but what the fundamental factors are in the model that was used to create this recommendation, so you can explain it to the customer.
Okay, here's my first dumb question. Analytics isn't solely for financial decision-making or marketing and product development decisions. It seems to have unlimited application for decisions, correct?
Well, yeah. If you can get data on it, then you can do analytics on that particular decision. So one of the faster-growing areas in business right now for analytics is human resources, which, you know, was historically a bit of a laggard, I would say. We relied on people and intuition to make people-based decisions. And I think there are still some things that people do well and better than analytics in that regard. But if you're trying to decide what traits lead to success in a job, in most cases, you'll be better off doing some analysis and figuring out what are the traits that lead to high performance or who's most likely to be departing an organization. As a lot of people think they're good with their intuition in that regard, but it's not always true. So analytics are growing very rapidly in human resources and, as you mentioned, marketing and supply chain and even business strategy.
And I think the good news is that analytical decision making is more accurate and precise in producing better outcomes. Can you elaborate a little on that?
Well, in general, that is true. There are always mitigating circumstances. If you can't get good data, or if the particular decision that you're making involves something that's never been done before, then you probably can't, and hence can't really use analytics. But there's a large body of academic research that suggests in almost every area of life, business and otherwise, the data and analytics-based approach tends to create more accurate decisions. We saw it in sports with Moneyball. If you're choosing players and you do that analytically, you get better players than if you think you have an intuition about how good someone might be, or the time-tested experience of the scouts has proved not to be as useful as a more analytical approach based on actual performance. And I think that's generally true everywhere. Even if you can't get data, you can do a small scale test with a control group, which is another form of analytical decision making, and make your decision on the basis of that.
Okay, second dumb question. Is analytics easy to master?
Obviously, you know, becoming really serious quant is not an easy thing to do, and I think some people have more of a facility for that kind of thinking than others. But I don't think it's that hard to at least understand enough so that you know the basis behind some decisions that affect your organization and your life. And that's what we tried to do in this recent book, is to say, okay, you don't need to know a huge amount, but you do need to know some things, and here are the steps in analytical thinking, and here's some different ways to gather data, and so on. It just makes it much better for you to ask questions and push back a little bit in an informed way. One of the worst things that you can do if somebody says, well, our analytical decisions suggest this, you know, to just kind of mindlessly agree to it without asking any questions or learning any more about how they attack the problem.
So it's important to know something about analytics so that, if nothing else, you understand how the decision is being made.
Yeah, I mean, if the decision has any importance to you, you need to make sure that it was made well, and to understand a little bit about what data was used and what kind of mathematical or statistical model was applied, and was the person who did the work responsible in their approach to it. You know, there can be some ambiguity often in analytical decisions and outcomes, and so you'd like to understand a little bit more about it before you place your faith in it.
And what's the best way to teach somebody analytical skills?
Well, the time-honored way was through classroom education, and I think that that is still a good approach. You know, as a professor, I guess I would have to believe that that is a good option. But there are an increasing number of ways now. There are online programs that you can go through. There are short little lessons, like Khan Academy type lessons, where you can learn about different aspects of statistics online for free. There are, of course, books, and our book is on that particular issue. So there are really a lot of options now. And another one, of course, is to work with more analytical people and ask them what their approaches and techniques are, and learn in a more informal way. But I think supplementing that with some formal training, whether it's classroom-based or some other approach, is often a good idea.
I was thinking that in some companies, there may be an interest in using mentors or coaches, but there's a danger in doing that, because if mistakes were made in the past, they might just be replicated on the next group of people. Wouldn't that be the case?
Well, it would. And if, you know, if the mentor or the coach is not particularly good at analytical thinking, it would not be terribly helpful. I think that mentors and coaches can establish a cultural tone around analytical thinking. You know, they can set an example for the rest of the organization. They can communicate that in this company, we make decisions on the basis of facts and analysis, but it can be, I think, quite idiosyncratic whether that particular coach is a good analytical decision maker. And if they're not, as you suggest, it can cause a lot of problems. So if you make sure that the people who are doing the coaching are very well trained and capable, then it could be a very successful approach. In our book, we give an example of a woman manager of clinical operations at Cigna, the health insurance company, and she has an MBA. She's a nurse with an MBA and has, you know, a little bit of quantitative training, but she was feeling dissatisfied with the kinds of reports that she was getting. She couldn't really understand from the reports whether her group's work, which is to try to keep Cigna's customers or members out of the hospital, you know, after they've had a disease like diabetes or heart disease, how do you avoid rehospitalization issues, which is not typically good for the patient or the insurance company. And so she started working with her analytical people and learned about the different types of experimental designs and realized that there were ways that she could establish cause and effect for whether her group's call center calls with patients were really having an effect. So in that case, working with the analytics group was a form of coaching and mentoring for her, and she's gotten much more understanding about it.
So analytics enhances decision-making, but what kinds of decisions are we really talking about here? Once again, it seems like an unlimited number.
Well, it is a large number. As I say, I think the limiting factor in many cases is whether you can really get data or not. And the decisions that are most likely to allow gathering and using data tend to be the more repetitive, structured decisions. So, what price should we charge for our products and services? What particular promotion should we offer to an individual customer? Those are things that you do over and over and over again, and you can learn from them. You can gather data on what you've tried and what works, and you can make them better through analytics. The hard decisions for analytics are the ones where you've never done that thing before, where you've never done a new type of marketing campaign, for example, so that makes it quite difficult to get any data and do a model. As I say, and in many cases, I think if you have the time, you should do a little controlled experiment and see, does the thing that you're believing will have an effect, does it really have an effect? But in many cases, we can't even do that just because, you know, it takes a little while to set those up.
The so-called big data that you have to accumulate and add to the analysis.
Well, yeah, sometimes it's big and sometimes it's small. Big data is the fashionable term right now. Typically, you're talking about, in that case, terabytes and terabytes, even into petabytes of data. And you would find that in, for example, decision-making about what website design you wanted to use in an organization. There might be millions and millions of clicks that you can gather data on and start to understand, well, does this format yield more conversions or does that format? So that's one big source of big data.
So your earlier book was on analytics as a tool for competition. Can you share with us examples of how analytics helped an organization compete and make the right decision? And it doesn't have to be a big company, something perhaps even a small decision that made changes in the success of a company.
Sure, there are lots of them, some in traditional businesses like banking, some in more contemporary businesses like, you know, online search. So in banking, one of the great analytical competitors from the beginning of its founding was Capital One, or is Capital One, which uses analytics for a whole variety of decisions, mostly around marketing and customer service. I think we've all probably received what we might have considered junk mail from Capital One advertising their credit cards, but it's actually almost more of a scientific experiment than it is junk mail in a way. So if you don't respond to that 12.9% balance transfer offer that you get in the mailbox or now in email, next month you'll get a 12.8% one. If you don't respond to a red envelope, next time you'll get a blue envelope. So it's all very carefully monitored what response you get from different types of customers. And even if you decide to call and cancel your credit card based on your value as a customer, you might get a very different response. You might get, okay, thanks for working with us. We're sorry to lose you, but I understand your decision. Or if you were a highly valuable customer, you might be shunted immediately based on automatic decision criteria to someone who's very good at reconciling the doubts people like you might have. You might get the interest rate on your loan balance renegotiated on the spot, or special offers of one type or another, all carefully orchestrated to have you make the decision that's favorable to Capital One. And for the first 10 years it was in business, it returned more value to shareholders than any other company in the history of the United States. We also see it in search every day. Google was the one who really brought serious analytics to web search and then to advertising around web search. And obviously, that's a pretty successful company, too.
The next question has to do with framing a problem. That's a critical step in analytics. I personally think that it may be one of the most important, because how you frame that problem that you're trying to solve will influence, to some extent, the results.
Very much influences the results. And if you frame a decision badly or incorrectly, then it's really hard to recover, no matter how good your analytics are. I always talk about one very simple aspect of framing is, are you seriously considering alternatives in your decision? Many decision makers don't do that often enough. They prematurely converge on a particular way of framing the decision, and it often ends badly. And this is a well-known problem. A term for it, groupthink, was coined by Irving Janis in the 1950s, yet we see over and over again in both corporate and political life that organizations converge on a particular framing too quickly and don't take the time to consider alternatives. And as I say, no matter what analytics you have, if you frame the question wrong from the beginning, you're not going to be very successful in getting a good outcome.
So one of the reasons that some should get outside training at that stage for framing the question is to go to an objective source for information on how to frame the question or how to frame the problems.
I think even just the idea of using more people in a decision process to help you frame it better. Often when people are senior executives within organizations, you know, they think they got there because of their ability to make good decisions, but not relying effectively on advisors can be a big problem in not framing the decision well, not realizing what data might be available. So I think the days of the lone, heroic decision maker with the golden gut, if they ever really existed, are long gone now.
In the book, you, of course, talk about the importance of hard numbers, but you also warn not to trust numbers. Why is that?
Well, every analytical model has assumptions built into it, you know, assumptions about what the relevant data are. Unless you've got a huge amount of big data, you are dealing with a sample, not the entire population. So you're making assumptions about to what population can we generalize from this sample. Maybe you gathered the data 5 years ago, but you're making assumptions that it's still relevant now because, you know, data always comes from the past. Maybe you're making an assumption that the future will continue to be like the past, and it usually will replicate what happened before, but not always. You know, we saw in the financial crisis with some of these mortgage models that they only worked when housing prices were going up. And so it's important to articulate those assumptions, to discuss them, and if you're going to be affected by this decision and this analytical thinking process, to question them and ask, what are the assumptions behind your model, and how do we know that those are still the case today, and how did you frame the problem in the first place? So you need to play a pretty active role in the process for decisions that are going to affect you or your customers.
Do you have examples of some smaller or perhaps mid-sized companies that are all over this analytical skill and analytical analysis? You know, do you have anything that might be able to share with us on anything that's sort of lesser, you know? Well, Capital One or some of the other ones you've mentioned, they're very big names. What about smaller or mid-sized?
Well, I do generally work with larger companies because they, for whatever reason, have adopted analytical thinking processes, in most cases earlier than small to mid-sized companies. But I did, in my last book, it's a book called Judgment Calls with Brooke Manville, I did write about with him several different small to medium-sized companies. One was a home builder in the suburbs of Boston, and it was called The House That Wouldn't Sell. And it was about a house that this company had built that nobody would buy, at least not initially. The owner had a hypothesis that there would be more baby boomers moving into this particular development, and they would want bedrooms on the first floor and a different configuration. And at least initially, that didn't turn out to be the case. So this particular business owner has a philosophy of using analytics, but in a, I would say, you know, not a highly structured way. He basically, when he has something that he doesn't understand, like this particular issue of, you know, why the house wasn't selling, he convened a, I guess you might say, the wisdom of the crowd. And the crowd in this case, anybody with an informed opinion about it, including his family members who work for the company, the other employees, about 12 of them, subcontractors who've worked on the house, customers who purchased other houses in the neighborhood. And as a result of the feedback that they got from all of these sources, they ended up reconfiguring different aspects of the house, and it sold pretty quickly. So I think it can be done by small to medium organizations, but it's certainly the case that one of the reasons why Walmart got to be the size of Walmart, or Capital One got to be the size of Capital One, is because they use these approaches. So if you're a small to medium organization and you don't use these approaches, then other competitors are going to have an edge over you.
It seems to me that these small to medium-sized companies can benefit from analytics without all of the financial or, well, the big data that can bring people with experience who can come in and bring their ideas. For example, this gentleman who was trying to sell a house, this is another form of analytics.
It is. As I said, it's a little less structured form of analytics typically, but, you know, it's a way of gathering data and sourcing data wherever you can get it, I think, is a good thing. The other thing that almost any small business can do now is use some systematic analytical thinking about the web presence. Almost every business now has a website. Google Analytics is provided for free to anybody who wants it. So if you want to get more effective at that, I think, very important aspect of your business, there's really no excuse now for a small to medium enterprise to not use some analytical approaches around your website design and development.
How important is how you describe the findings from your analytics? Does that influence the final decisions and maintenance of those decisions?
Well, very much. Unfortunately, I think our analytical professionals tend to think that the most important stage of analytical thinking is, you know, solving the problem and, you know, creating the model, gathering the data, figuring out what type of algorithm or equation to use. But decision makers typically are not going to trust that kind of analysis unless it's communicated effectively to them. So I always tell analysts that they need to learn to tell a story with data. Story needs to be in business-oriented terms. In many cases, managers are going to want it in terms of how does it change my ROI, what does it do for my lift in terms of what customers buy or my conversion rate. So figure out what the language of your business is and tell a story about how this particular intervention will change it. Unfortunately, many analysts like to tell stories in terms of, well, you know, first I transform the data using logarithmic transformation, and then I tried this particular nonlinear regression approach, and that didn't work very well, so I lagged the variables by a year. You know, and they speak in terms of the analytical methods that they use, not the business outcomes and implications that most decision makers are going to want to hear about.
Earlier, we were talking about dealing with customers. I think the same is true, that if you have to take those analytics and convert them into language that a customer would appreciate and sell.
That is true, and I've experienced this a few times at my own bank. The banks now, large ones anyway, will have recommendations for particular customers. You know, you should buy a CD, or why don't you invest this with our brokerage arm, and so on. And I'll often say, oh, yeah, why do you think that's the case? You know, what's the basis for that recommendation? And in many cases, they'll, you know, sort of point at the computer. Well, it says right here, you know, recommend CD to customer, which is not likely to compel me to go along with that advice. On the other hand, if they had said, well, you know, taking into account what we know about your asset levels, your tolerance for risk, the fact that you will be retiring in 5 years or whatever, you know, then I might trust the recommendation and actually go along with it. But it has to be in terms that are personalized to me and that will make me find those recommendations credible.
So the lower in the organization, the more important it is for them to understand, if not practice it, understand the analytics so they can explain in layman's terms the process that the company goes through to give them information that might help them.
Customer-facing decisions, I think that is definitely true. Now, a lot of analytical questions don't involve customers and, you know, are really an interaction between a quantitative analyst and a decision maker who's a, you know, a manager or an executive. And it's just as important there, even when a customer's not involved.
And I have one last question. What role do you see analytics assuming in the future? How will it grow in importance?
Well, I don't see that there will be much decrease in the amount of data that we have available. More and more sources of data all the time with the internet and with sensors on a lot of industrial devices. Our cell phones, our mobile phones generate massive amount of data about where we are and who we're talking to and so on. So we'll have the ability to apply that data in more and more analytical decisions over time. I just don't see this trend reversing. And in fact, if you look at every measure of the analytics industry, certainly the demand for quantitative people has gone up like a rocket over the past decade or so. I just don't see that changing. The real constraint is the human side. Can we find enough people who both can do the serious quantitative analysis and also people who have the desire and the need to make analytical decisions?
We've been speaking to Thomas Davenport, renowned thought leader and author. His new book is entitled Keeping Up with the Quants. Tom, thanks for being with us here today.
Okay, thank you.
Follow the American Management Association on Twitter to learn about upcoming free programs, the latest news, management insights, and special offers. You can follow us at AMANET. That's AMANET. Hope to tweet to you real soon. Here at the AMA, we value your feedback. If you've ever attended any of our webcasts, webinars, or seminars, you've no doubt encountered our feedback surveys. Well, our podcasts are no different. You can either email us at podcast@amanet.org or call 800-697-3406. Your comments may become part of a future program. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.